Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, this week's reinvention story and another blast from the past with rediscovered radio. Later in the program, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, in 2004, Ohio voters approved a statewide ban on gay marriage, defining marriage as between one man and one woman. The law says same-sex marriages can be performed in Ohio, and legal marriages performed in other states won't be recognized. Now, a federal judge says part of that law is unconstitutional, and he's expected to issue a ruling Monday, striking it down. The issue of gay marriage has many fronts, and two Ohio organizations advocating for same-sex marriage are traveling the state to get their message out: Equality Ohio and Why Marriage Matters. Michael Primo is with Why Marriage Matters. I spoke to him at last week's town hall meeting in Dayton. First, a bit about the organization.
Why Marriage Matters Ohio is a public education campaign that is a coalition of state and national partners that has come together to help increase support for marriage equality in Ohio.
Your business here today, you weren't just preaching to the choir. You were talking to around 30 people about how to get out and be activists and further the cause of marriage equality?
Yeah, the most important thing that anybody can do who supports marriage equality is talk about it with their family and friends and their coworkers and their neighbors. And so what we do at these town hall meetings is we talk with people about how to talk about marriage, and using some really tried and true techniques that we've seen work in Ohio and in other states as well, drawing on our national and state level experience as to how to approach it in a way that is, the conversation is respectful and polite, and does not and stays positive, but also allows people to share how they feel about marriage equality and why it's important.
Tell me, what are the steps that you're asking people to take or that they can take?
Well, the first one is to never presume where somebody stands on the issue of marriage equality. People will be surprised. Number two is to create a safe space where people can express how they feel about marriage equality without being subjected to judgment. Number three is to actively listen to when somebody is explaining how they feel about the issue. And then for folks who support marriage equality to share their story and why they support it and why it's important to them. And then to agree to follow up the conversation afterwards. These conversations take time. They don't happen overnight. And so, you have to go back several times and continue the conversation.
You don't have to go into details on everything that's going on, but how do you think Ohio is progressing on the matter?
We are moving in the right direction. The polling shows that registered voters, it's now around 50%. We know that 50% in a poll doesn't mean 50% on election day, so we know we have a lot of work to do. But support is growing, and with an aggressive public education campaign that we're doing, we think that support will continue to grow, and we'll be ready to go to the ballot in 2016 if needed.
Let's talk about Judge Black's announcement about his upcoming decision and what kind of reaction that you have to that personally.
Well, I was in the courtroom when he made the announcement in Cincinnati, and we were all thrilled. We think it's the absolute right decision, and we look forward to him releasing his decision. It's not everything that we want, but it's a huge step in the right direction toward full equality for all loving and committed couples, and that's what we're working toward.
There will be opposition to his decision, and what do you expect that opposition to be, and where do you expect it to go?
Well, the opposition is there. They're mobilizing already because they know that we're working hard to increase the level of support for marriage equality. So they're organizing, and we expect that they're going to be formidable if we go to the ballot. But we know that we have the not-so-secret weapon on our side of these amazing stories of love and commitment and families that deserve protection and dignity and respect. And they don't have that. All they have is fear and divisiveness. And we've seen in other states where we've gone to the ballot in 2012, we swept all four states where marriage equality was on the ballot because we know how to message this and highlight those stories of love and commitment, and nothing can challenge that. I mean, we've got the right message.
Any further comments?
We just want everybody who supports marriage equality to get out and talk to their family and friends. It's the number one thing they can do to get this issue, to get marriage equality for all loving and committed couples. And we look forward to the day where I'm out of work and we have full marriage equality in Ohio.
Michael Primo with Why Marriage Matters Ohio. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency hired a third party to conduct a public forum Wednesday night in Springfield to discuss the agency's plan to clean up the Tremont City landfill.
As WYSO's Wayne Baker reports, several residents showed up to voice their displeasure concerning the EPA's decision to rebury some of the waste and empty drums at the site instead of removing it all.
Why'd they hire you? Why don't they get the thing cleaned up? That's what we want.
That was the question posed to Joseph McMahon of Collaborative Processes LLC, the contractor hired by EPA to spend a few days in Springfield in order to find out why citizens oppose the agency's current cleanup plan for the Superfund site. McMahon says that he understands that it's an emotional issue for people living in the area.
It's an informed community. There's some data they want. There certainly are some levels of frustration that need to be addressed, and there are some questions that they would like to see answered.
In a written statement, EPA says its current approach is environmentally safe and meets government guidelines for cleaning up the Superfund site. Clark County Commissioner David Hartley is one of the many local officials supporting the EPA's original plan to remove all of it. He says McMahon's visit amounts to political gamesmanship by the EPA.
I think this is trying to smooth it out, make us happy, quiet us down. I don't think that's going to happen.
Marilyn Welker from the group People for Safe Water agrees with Hartley.
We're going to stand strong and hard that we want all that hazardous waste removed and permanently stored elsewhere.
Another public meeting will be held April 21st at Wittenberg University. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
Also last week, the Dayton Development Coalition sponsored their 30th annual Washington Fly-In. About 100 community and civic leaders from Dayton flew into Washington to promote the Gem City. Michael Gessel is with the coalition. I spoke to him on day two of the trip.
The Dayton Region Community Leader Washington Fly-In, which is now in its 30th year, is the community's attempt to show our support for our federal government installations, including Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Springfield Air National Guard Base, the Dayton Veterans Administration Medical Center, and the Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historical Park. These organizations are a source of a number of jobs in the Dayton region, and we want to make sure that our elected officials know how concerned we are and supportive of these institutions.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you think these fly-ins have done? How have they been successful?
Well, the fly-ins lay the groundwork of support for the community effort for showing how much we care about these institutions. The fly-ins are an opportunity for us to speak in one voice and show up en masse in Washington to demonstrate that support. And I think the success of the fly-ins as part of a broader community advocacy effort are that Wright-Patterson is robust, particularly in a time of downsizing. We're still strong. We still employ about 27,000 people. And our other federal installations, too, are still strong. And that's the sign of success.
You mentioned that there are about 100 representatives from Dayton. Can you tell me who is participating? These are public and private business leaders and community leaders?
Yes, that's right. We have mayors, we have city managers, we have county commissioners, we have people connected with universities, private businesses. It's a large group of civic and community leaders.
As far as Dayton is concerned, what city leaders are attending?
We have our new Dayton City Mayor, Nan Whaley. We have members of the Greene County Commission. We have members of the Montgomery County Commission.
Michael, I appreciate this. Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Coming up next in Under Construction, WYSO's Lewis Wallace reports on another pro-Dayton effort that took place this week.
Welcome to Under Construction, WYSO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. I'm Lewis Wallace. Dayton's got a problem with brain drain. That's what it's called when young people get a great education here, then leave to use those skills somewhere else. The organization Up Dayton was created in part to combat that. It's now in its sixth year and holding a summit this Friday. I caught up with Up Dayton director Laura Estandia, and I asked her to give me the pitch. Why stick around?
You should stay because you can have everything you want. So, number one, low cost of living. Number two, you can have the urban nightlife that you want to experience. The bars, the breweries, restaurants, entertainment, world-class arts. But then it only takes you, 15 minutes to get out in the country, to hike, to see nature, to be under the stars in the sky. You know, if you're in Chicago or some other big city, that takes hours to get to that kind of experience. But you can have all of that in Dayton, and that's really why I personally love it here, is because I can have all of those things and also have a say in my city, because Dayton cares about what you think.
What have UpDayton's success rates been like? Can you quantify if more young people are sticking around?
Well, we've been tracking the brain drain essentially through census data currently. And that has allowed us to measure two things, talent potential and talent realized. So the potential is how many residents you have in school. And then the talent realized is how many degrees you have at the time that census data is taken. And Dayton has seen has a very large gap compared to Columbus, compared to the state of Ohio in general. The good news is that we also have the most talent potential. We also have the most students in school. So there's a lot of potential for us to grow. And census data, I mean, it's a few years behind, but I think that what we're seeing is at least a slowing of that occurring. And certainly with the economy turning around, that's also making a difference.
I want to ask you about the name UpDayton. Can you tell me where that comes from and what kind of reactions you've gotten to it?
I don't really know. I feel like I asked one of the original, the folks who started UpDayton, how they came up with it. And it was like someone's sister came up with the name. And I think it's a play on updating, like updating Dayton, updating.
But does Dayton need to be updated? Sometimes that sounds like maybe the implication of it. Is it behind something?
I think maybe. And I would definitely say that when we came out of the 2007-2008 recession, I think it was a different time for Dayton. I don't really know for sure because I was in college and in the bubble and wasn't really aware of much going on. But I knew enough as a college student to know that when I graduated and decided to stay in Dayton, I knew enough about Dayton that I knew it had a self-image problem. And I knew that there were a lot of people who found fault with the city, especially if they were from here. There's one person on our board, the board of UpDayton, who's not a transplant. So I think that says a lot about, you know, people, you know, being engaged, who are from here, and folks that are kind of from the outside and look at it with fresh eyes and say, hey, there's actually a lot to do here and a lot to see.
That's Laura Estandia with UpDayton. They're reaching out to college students to try to convince them to stay in the area after school. And this is Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. We dig underneath the physical and economic markers of growth to look at the human consequences. For WISO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
I'm Jerry Kenny. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Today on Reinvention Stories, we go to the Dayton View neighborhood, northwest of downtown, and meet Don Dominick. He remembers good times in the 1960s, growing up in a close-knit family in a neighborhood that was economically vibrant. But everything changed in the 1980s when the city faced an epidemic of crack cocaine use, and Dominick himself became addicted. Producer Basim Blunt has Don Dominick's story of reinvention.
How do you make a way when there's no way? As Dayton lost its manufacturing base and the economy hit a slump, the Dayton View community faced its own struggles. There was an exodus of middle-class families and chain restaurants that left for the suburbs. On several blocks, drugs were sold openly. But John Dominick found a way, and he's a community activist with a vision.
I got a job at the Goodwill, which is a good organization that does a lot to help poor people. It's hard work and a few dollars, but hopefully it'll get better before I get too old.
Dominick is 52. He was raised in a General Motors household of three generations from the Dayton View neighborhood.
My grandparents bought this house in 1972. At the time, this was a very good neighborhood, a diverse neighborhood. There were whites and blacks here. We could leave our doors open. We could leave our bikes out in the yard. I mean, it was wonderful growing up. We had all the things that we needed.
Family has always been a big part of Dominic's life. He was a high school teenager when Dayton integrated its public schools.
In 1975, I was a freshman at Colonel White, and that's when they desegregated the schools in Dayton. They would bus white kids to black schools and black kids to white schools. At that time, we began to see what's now known as white flight. Hundreds of white families left, which affected the quality of life in this city. This neighborhood really took a bad hit. About 10 years later, in the mid-80s, we seen the crack epidemic hit Dayton really hard.
Like many communities, the cocaine 80s ravaged Dayton View. A powerful network of drug gangs battled with local police for control of the neighborhood.
And it was like somebody had dropped a nuclear bomb. Most of the people that I know are still struggling with some type of substance, whether it's cocaine, heroin, alcohol, or a combination of all of them. And I actually got hung up into the crack life myself, and I was addicted for 13 years.
Dominic's drug addiction was beginning to take its toll. He had frequent encounters with the police. He almost lost everything, and his family was beginning to fall apart as he hit rock bottom.
I was in a crack house down here down the street on Faulkner, and I had been there all night. And I came home about 6 that evening, and my wife and my grandfather and my kids were standing in front of the house. And my wife was pointing at me as I came up. And I was really actually ready to commit suicide. And I made a call to suicide hotline. And a young lady, I don't know her name now, but she saved my life. As I never looked back.
As he began his recovery, Dominic did what most addicts find impossible. He stayed in his community and became drug-free among the drug dealers, crack houses, and his former get-high partners.
I was blessed to be able to have the strength to stay in the neighborhood where I shamed myself at. I remember when I first got clean, I started jogging, and I'd come around the corner and the guys would just be rolling because they knew I was a dope fiend.
Dominic reinvented himself. He's been clean and sober for 19 years and some days. He rejoined his church and started a chapter of the Dayton Black Panther Party. Yes, the same Black Panther Party founded by Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver in the 60s. There was a 10-point economic and political program.
I had studied the Black Panther Party since I was a kid. The Black Panther Party has the platform that deals with the problems faced by the African American and other poor communities. We don't need a war on drugs, but a war on poverty. God just placed something in me, said, look, I need you to help make a change in the community. A lot of my friends today, white and black, are people that I helped get out of the drug life. The Panther is inside of me. It's become a part of, a big part of me.
For WYSO Reinvention Stories, this is producer Basim Blunt.
To see a short film about Don Dominic, visit WYSO.org. Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with support from Wright State University, Celia Fund, the Yellow Springs Community Foundation, and Antioch College. Up next on WYSO Weekend, the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center in Wilberforce opened its doors 26 years ago this April. Rediscovered radios, Jocelyn Robinson found historic audio in the WYSO archives and now offers a look at how the museum has fared over the years.
Back in the fall of 1980, WYSO News aired a story on the National Afro-American Museum project. Even then, according to reporter Brian McCormick, the museum had been in the works for a long time.
Wilberforce, Ohio is a historical landmark for black Americans. Named in honor of the great 18th century abolitionist William Wilberforce, its roots date back to 1884. Residents of Ohio felt it would be an appropriate spot to build a national Afro-American museum, and this triggered off what has long been a controversial issue in Ohio and the U.S. Congress.
By the mid-1980s, the museum was authorized by the federal government and ultimately funded by the state of Ohio. With the building finally under construction, it needed a collection. I spoke with Dr. John E. Fleming, the museum's founding director. He recalled how the first permanent exhibition was developed.
So we decided that we would collect from the present and go back into the past. So the most important decade, we felt, was the last decade of what we call segregation, the 1950s. And we defined the 1950s as 1945 to 1965. And we called it From Victory to Freedom. African Americans fought for victory overseas to return to the U.S. only to fight for their own freedom during the Civil Rights Movement.
Leading up to the museum's grand opening on April 16, 1988, the staff was busy putting the finishing touches on From Victory to Freedom, Afro-American Life in the 50s. I should know. I was on the team writing exhibit labels and training volunteer tour guides. Others were installing exhibit artifacts, like the 57 Chevy and the Green Book that listed safe accommodations for black travelers during the Jim Crow era. For its first 10 years, the Wilberforce facility was a leader in the black museum field, and it carried out a number of projects that were national in scope. Again, John Fleming.
I felt like Wilberforce certainly was an out-of-the-way place for a national museum, but if we define the mission and vision for the institution correctly, then it could carry out a national function. For example, we did produce national exhibitions that travel around the country. Even the Smithsonian took two of our traveling exhibits. We produced educational materials for school kids around the country. One particular curriculum package was used in 48 states. We produced a national television program for PBS on blacks in the Constitution.
In the last 10 years, though, the museum has seen devastating budget and personnel cuts, and in 2011, its aging infrastructure triggered a mold problem. The museum closed for 17 months, and the permanent exhibition was taken down. It was yet another hurdle to get over, but the museum has reopened. Director Charles Wash is optimistic, even though there is a new National Museum of African American History and Culture being built on the Washington Mall.
We've hopefully seen the darkest of days and just bright days ahead now. One phrase that I heard pretty often is that all history is local, and that that National Museum there on the Mall can't do justice to local history such as that in Wilberforce or even in Ohio as a whole.
Dr. Wash invites museum visitors of all backgrounds to use African American history and culture as a sort of blueprint for overcoming obstacles, as a force we can all use to propel us into a better future. And that's what the museum's current exhibition, How I Got Over, is all about.
How I Got Over.
Though the museum wasn't able to mark its 25th anniversary last year, a gala is being planned for this September. This National Museum has been collecting and preserving the African-American experience for nearly three decades, and that's worth celebrating. For Rediscovered Radio at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
I made it over. Going on over all these years. You know my soul, look back and wonder, how did I make it over? Tell me how we got over, Lord. Wonder, how did we make it over? Tell me how we got over. I've been falling and rising all these years.
To hear more audio and to see photos of the National Afro-American Museum over the years, visit WYSO.org. Major funding for Rediscovered Radio is provided by the Ohio Humanities Council and the Greene County Public Library. All around Southwest Ohio, spring flowers are blooming at last. University of Dayton professor Bob Brekka has a special interest in when those flowers bloom. He is the coordinator of an initiative at UD called Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment. And he's wondering how a changing climate will affect our local flora. Here's his commentary.
Climate change is already being felt by natural systems around the world and locally. We can see how flowers react to temperatures as they first emerge in the spring. And now we have a specific record for our area. For more than three decades, one avid local gardener has been keeping a diary of the first flowering dates of many species in her yard, like snowdrops, crocuses, bleeding hearts, and crabapples. A few years ago, she let a few of us at the University of Dayton see her observations. We had a hypothesis. We'd look through the diary and not find any patterns over time. To our surprise, it became clear that many flower species are blossoming earlier over time. Using local temperature data over the same period, we saw something else as well. First, although temperatures fluctuate, there was a small but significant upward trend over time. More importantly, there was a clear correlation between higher winter temperatures and spring blossoming times. According to the gardener's diary, crocuses were up and flowering nearly a month earlier in 2005 than in the 1970s. Many of us would be happy to have a few extra days of early spring. The catch is that the changes we're seeing are happening as much as 10 times faster than normal, natural rates of temperature change. It's not normal in any way. And there's a chain reaction. Once flowers start blossoming and trees start budding earlier, the cycles of insects and animals get out of sync as well, a ripple effect through the ecosystem. The earlier flowering times can be a problem for other creatures with life cycles triggered by lighting changes in the spring. Think about this. When oak tree buds appear earlier in the season, giving food for caterpillars, birds that hatch at their normal times are out of luck because their food source is already past its peak. Ecosystems will eventually adapt to climate change, as they always have. That's part of a natural cycle. But the changing climate now is the result of humans increasing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Unfortunately, we don't always know what is going to happen when we disrupt these natural systems. We don't get several trials, and we may not always like the unintended consequences of the one chance we do have. For WYSO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy. He is the coordinator of the Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment program at the University of Dayton. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of middle spring. The effects of the steady retreat of the night and the increasing temperatures of middle spring are always cumulative. By the year's 100th day, that's just 2 days from now, the resurrection of the landscape has reached a point of no return. All across the nation's midsection, the blooming of silver maples and red maples merges with the blooming of the sugar maples and the box elders. Honeysuckles are greening the roadsides, breaking the gray of winter undergrowth. In the wetlands, skunk cabbage has grown to more than half of its summer size. Bright yellow cowslip is opening, and watercress has filled the shallow brooks. At the forest edge, knotweed and nettles are tall enough to cup for supper. May apples spread their shade across last year's mulch. Deep in the woods, the momentum of time and weather opens the soft ginger and raises delicate morels from their mulch. Insects become more numerous now, encouraging the arrival of catbirds, indigo buntings, and scarlet tanagers. Honeybees indulge in the season of flowering pear, apple, and cherry trees. Young hummingbird moths come out to sip the annual mass flowering of dandelions. Above them all, the tall tree canopy is flushed and poised, ready to break out into May. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of middle spring. In the meantime, Thursday, April 10th, is the 100th day of the year. Celebrate a little bit. Thursday noons, between March 20th and April 24th, I will be the moderator of a seminar at the University of Dayton entitled The Inner Landscape. And these will be discussions about the almanac readings on WYSO. For more information, call the Special Programs Office at the University of Dayton, 937-229-2605.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio. Coming up next, The Book Nook.